Welcome to Education Explored, the Department of Education at the University of Oxford podcast. We've launched this series to explore all things education, from teaching to research to finding out why we're one of the leading departments in the country and the world. I'm your host, Heather Shirkinov, and this is episode 6 in the series. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Carol Brown, who is a former DPhil student of ours and has now come back to take up the position of departmental lecturer in educational assessment. Carol is a chartered psychologist as well as a qualified teacher, previously spending 15 years teaching A-level psychology. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks.
You've worked under our research centre, the Oxford University Centre for Educational Assessment, since the beginning of this year. How have you been finding it?
It's been a really valuable opportunity. The team are lovely. Everybody's been very welcoming. It's doing some cutting edge research, which is really interesting. So I'm also learning an awful lot, as well as hopefully contributing something. We've got some interesting DPhil students looking at innovative projects and students on the MEA. And what's been really lovely is that assessment cuts across so many other centres and research themes that I've been able to engage with all sorts of discussions about assessment across the department with different people who use assessment as part of their work, whether they're teacher educators or in other aspects of the department. So it's been a really interesting opportunity so far.
Your interests focus on the psychology of education and assessment. So walk our listeners through how you came into these areas of work.
Really, it was an opportunity. It wasn't something I planned. I was once in a lecture where somebody said, nobody plans to be an assessment researcher. Everybody who ends up in assessment kind of comes to it through a different route. So I had worked in mental health at the beginning of my career after my psychology degree. And then subsequently, I became a teacher, an A-level teacher. And what I found over the 15 years of my career is how much psychology interacts with education. So I would have students who would come to a class, and the way in which they perceived themselves was very much linked to the grades they were achieving or the opportunities they thought that were open to them or the expectations upon them by wider sources. And so I kind of fell into it. I got asked to do a research project on the achievement of white working class boys, and it hadn't really occurred to me as a teacher just how much psychology and research and education interacted. So following on from that project, I applied to do a DPhil here in the department and was fortunate enough to have a funded studentship as a very mature student. And so I came to research the links between A-level and identity and expectations and the effects on motivation. So it drew together the fields. And actually within the British Psychological Society, there is a section of which I'm incoming chair on the psychology of education. But often it's something that's missed in assessment. You know, in the assessment field, it's growing, but traditionally the field was very much ruled by psychometrics, the reliability and validity of assessment. And what I'm really interested in is what is the effect on these students that are actually sitting in your classroom as a teacher? So it very much came out through a mix of my academic interests and my occupational background. It wasn't a career route I planned. It was just the opportunity was there and I kind of fell into it, really.
And why isn't psychology considered in assessment more in that way?
I think it's a growing field. So there are some researchers now, but I think traditionally it has very much focused on making sure things are reliable and fair and equitable. And I think that is really important. I think it's becoming more considered because we are becoming more aware as of society and as psychologists of issues around neurodivergence, mental health issues, for example, the stress and anxiety that we have a high stakes testing system in the UK. And that has become much more prominent, you know, from when children are doing SATs in primary school right the way through to the GCSEs and A-levels. And these are really high stakes. So I think it wasn't something that's considered, but the landscape has changed. The pressure on young people have changed. The opportunities available to them have changed. And so I think the emphasis on the psychological aspects and the social implications of assessment has become a wider field over time, a more relevant field in a modern society.
And you mentioned that we have high stakes assessment in the UK. How does that differ from other areas?
I mean, internationally, we're not the only country that has high stakes assessment. we are, as a country, some of the most over-tested. And when you look at things like the PISA surveys, what's interesting is the UK reports some of the most unhappiest children. So I think it's the combination of the degree of testing, the importance of that testing for future progression and life chances. There's a whole raft of literature as to what pathways people can pursue, especially following GCSEs or A-levels. Obviously, there was a curriculum change that came in where now students can't leave school at 16. They have to stay in future education or training. So that's also shifted the landscape over the last 10 years or so. And that isn't the case in other countries. So I think we're unique in lots of ways.
And presumably in a post-COVID world, that has had an effect as well, because we know that mental health issues and all sorts of things have come in for children and young people who've gone through that. Do you think that therefore the assessment landscape needs to reflect that?
I think it's an interesting question. And of course, there were times when the assessment landscape did have to change in accordance with the COVID. Yeah. Of course, it was hugely controversial. You know, you couldn't pick up a newspaper. We had the years that the exams were cancelled,
yeah.
Years where teacher grades were awarded. Interestingly, I had funding for a study to look at the links between identity and A-levels, and the funding and the ethics had been granted permission, and then COVID kicked in. And it really changed the shape of that study, because we'd been interviewing students about what effect A-levels would have on their future choices and their sense of identity. And suddenly the whole group of students we were interviewing no longer were doing their A-level exams. They were all given teacher assessed grades. And so I was able to get some really clear insight into what are the alternatives. You know, we can sit here and say, oh, we're an over-tested country and, you know, A-levels aren't fair and there's a lot of pressure on students. But actually, when we removed that and we put in different measures, it gave students different sets of problems. So we would have students saying, well, I don't really feel like I deserve those grades. I wasn't really tested properly. You know, how was the system fair? They felt it was more subjective. So I don't think there is an easy way round of solving the problems around assessment. You know, you could say, yes, OK, we need an alternative system. But what is the alternative? And is that better?
If you could redo the whole assessment system, where would you start?
I think I would evaluate to what extent we need to be testing children to the extent we do in primary school. And the reason for that is that by the time students reach secondary school, they already have some kind of concept of the person they think they are, which can already be shaped by those assessments. You know, I'm a level X. I'm in this group. I'm the top person. I'm never going to get anywhere because I'm in the bottom group. I mean, you know, obviously they don't verbalise it in that way. But children's sense of self develops from a really young age. And we know that the school, as well as the home environment, is really important in that. So if we're testing from a young age, already we're giving students that sense of self. It's an age old problem. You know, years ago, you had the 11 plus, obviously, in some places you still do. And you had the second modern grammar system. So at 11, those decisions were already made for students. At 11, those children, in effect, already have a concept of the person they think they're going to be. So for me personally, I would reduce the kind of testing regime we have on young students and work out, are there better ways of ensuring students reach standards of equitability by the time they're at secondary school, but without it being such an inherent part of the system. I think as you go up further through school, there has to be some form of high stakes testing. I don't think we can avoid that. Whether we want it to the degree we have it now with the number of exams in a short space of time and the emphasis we place on those for university level entry, I think could do with some revision. I think making students aware there are many other opportunities for them. You know, there are apprenticeship routes or vocational routes, and making that more widely available so that students don't feel everything rests on those high stakes qualifications. There's been lots of research done on fear appraisals by somebody called Dave Putwain, and he has done research which found that in average classrooms, teachers will quite frequently make reference to the importance of those qualifications, so that that becomes an inherent part of a student's thinking. Now, if we have a system set up in the way we do, then that becomes an inevitable consequence when schools are accountable. I don't have an easy answer, but I think there are small wins we could make that would make a difference to the landscape overall.
The current assessment system that we've got in the UK, Do you have a sense of the sort of person that it would service well, or the sorts of people that it really doesn't?
I think there's mixed evidence on this. What we do know in the research I've done, we've looked at outcomes as well as expectations and values. And largely it shows that those from higher socioeconomic groups do better in these systems. And that tends to be a fairly universal finding. Gender differences, less so. There's very mixed evidence. This goes through times, phases. There have been phases that have shown girls have done better. There are phases that have shown gaps are narrowing. But the socioeconomic gap tends to remain and has remained for many, many years within the kinds of systems that we have set up.
In a former life, but still you're using the skills from currently, you're a psychologist, but you were also previously training to be a social worker. How did that come about and how did you change career paths?
So I originally did my psychology degree and was thinking at the time of doing clinical psychology, like I think lots of people in psychology do. So I was trying to gain experience. So I started working within a community mental health team during my degree and subsequently for the year after. I thought it would be useful to have some qualification to substantiate that experience, but also a master's degree. So I originally came to Oxford in 1996 to 1998 to do a combined master's in applied social studies and a diploma in social work. So that also involved further placements where I was in mental health. I also worked in juvenile justice for a while. And that was actually a really useful experience. Those 5 years were invaluable, I think, for the whole future of my career, whatever route it took in terms of being aware of the social structures. The applied social sciences degree covered more than psychology. It covered social policy, it covered law, sociology. So it gave me a broader view of the field in which I was situated, as well as different opportunities for work experience with different groups. At the end of that time, I'd taken a part-time job teaching A-level psychology at night school and actually really loved it. So I did an unintended career switch and ended up becoming an A-level psychology teacher. And that really solidified a lot of those experiences because, and I would still say the same in an academic career in HE, because it is more than the research. You've got a really big pastoral element, rightly or wrongly. And lots of people say that's not our job as teachers or lecturers. For me personally, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that view. So I would say that I have been able to use those skills that I gained in working in mental health and as a qualified social worker in so many different ways, working with young people in schools and actually young people in higher education. And without the constraints of a system that was set up, you know, in my early career, I was working with people who only had long-term and enduring mental health problems often, where problems were really ingrained and you were coming to them really late. Whereas I think the advantage of being able to use those skills in wider settings is you could pull on them at a time where you really could make a difference for young people. So I think, you know, they've underpinned a lot of what I've done and still the research that I do. I don't think they've been separate careers. I think they've been an integration of careers that have all just converged on the career that I've got now and the research that I do. Because for me, research is really about having an impact. Yes. But I think having an understanding of what it's like to be on those grassroots with those people and with the wider kind of academic knowledge around that as well, I think has been really invaluable.
You started your DPhil here at the department in October 2012. And your topic was, what motivates A-level students to achieve? The role of expectations and values, research investigating the relationship between achievement, motivation, identity and educational outcomes, including gender and socioeconomic differences. Why that topic specifically?
So that topic specifically, what I was trying to understand is what does motivate students to achieve? You know, schools are keen for students to do as well as they can for life chances. But we know for some students, they don't fulfil their potential. Many do. Why? What is the difference for those students? And so I was really interested in looking at that data and gaining more knowledge about that. So it was a really big study, especially for a DPhil. So I interviewed students about how they perceived A-levels and identity to link. So you would have some students who would give you the expected answer. You know, I'm going to get all A's. Everyone in my family is a doctor. This is the career I want and I'm on track for that. But there were other stories that were different. There were stories in really socioeconomically deprived areas where there was a new sixth form, had a handful of students, and one of the students said, I now feel like I'm a better person. I've got this opportunity. Nobody in my family's done A-levels. I didn't think I could do this. And now I think I've got different opportunities. You know, that's education at its best. But we often don't ask students those questions. Or one student who was doing really badly in A-levels, and he was saying, the thing is, I don't care. Because I come from the Philippines, I've never been back to my home country. All I want to do is finish my A-levels and go and find out more about who I am and about my roots. So I don't really care what I'm going to get. But these are the stories you don't capture with large-scale data. Alongside that, I did actually collect large-scale data. So I had just over 1,000 students from a range of schools across one county. And what I examined was their expectations for their A-levels, how well did they expect to do, their value they placed on them, and whether they were interested in them, whether they enjoyed them, whether they expected to do well in them, or whether there were costs to them of doing those A-levels, like, you know, I'm doing so much work for my A-levels, I can't play basketball, was one example. And I measured, if you like, for want of a better description, their expectations and values for A-levels. And what it found was if you expected to do well and you valued them, you would do well. Sounds really obvious. But how often do we ask students whether they value what they're doing? You know, they're stuck on a trajectory. That some of those students have chosen that, but others may not. But I'd captured this just as the curriculum changes came in and they had to stay in school or training until they were 18. So I was able to capture some of that data and look at how that affected the effort that they would put into their A-levels, the grades they achieved, and to then explore whether there were gender differences and socioeconomic differences in achievement that could be explained by both their expectations and values and their sense of identity. And I think that's quite a novel perspective. You know, it shows that our psychology around assessment is really integral to whether we're motivated and subsequently whether we do achieve. So it was quite an ambitious project, but it found some really interesting results. The model's been used extensively, usually in the States, but it explains why students make choices. So why originally it was around why do girls not do STEM or maths? And it was to do with this values and expectations, but this model hadn't been tested with A-level students before. So that's where the background to the study came from. The good thing about this model is it not only looks at the expectations and values as psychological variables, but explains, it's a very complex model, but it explains that our expectations and values in life are shaped by what's come before. So it's, for example, our prior attainment, how well we've done in something before, our demographic variables, our social cultural background. So it's quite a sophisticated model, but it takes into both the social context and our psychology in order to explain how we achieve. And I think that's quite a unique perspective on assessment.
Yeah, I mean, and understanding that, presumably you could really change outcomes for people. I don't know how you go about that. I don't know.
Well, there is actually, there's a whole set of literature that comes out of this field of the expectancy value model that says you can, because right. What you do is you work out interventions that enhance expectations and values from a young age. So if I'm making this up as an example, but you can have an intervention which targets groups that you would know traditionally might not value educational qualifications, and you target those interventions within school systems early in the system, you know, kind of raising aspiration, raising expectations, if you want to put it in a different way. And we know there's a whole load of literature on that. So actually it has been devised so that you can actually create interventions that can make a real difference to outcomes. And that's what I like about it. It's not just a model where you're saying, oh, I'm going to be a researcher and I'm just going to take this research and see what happens. Yeah. You're actually looking at the social background kids come from, looking at their experiences, measuring how that fits their psychology. But then you're able to say, well, if we know this, we can make a difference here by devising an intervention that targets those groups, those students, their expectations, their values, and we know that that can make a difference. And the interventions do make a difference. You know, lots of research has shown that.
And how much does the parent role play in this?
I mean, we know there's a huge raft of literature about socioeconomic class and social cultural resources and educational outcomes. That is not something that's new. But what this model does is it shows that parents, peers and teachers are the key role models for students. And actually, when I did my study, I interviewed and collected questionnaire data on who is it who's influenced the choices that you've made. And they were, you know, universally across the board.
If there are any parents listening to this podcast today and their children are sort of pre-A-level thinking about what subjects to take, what advice would you give on how best to support their child?
I think gain as much information as you can so that you understand what they're talking about. So that you can engage in those conversations. And if you don't have the information, ask. You know, find out. Don't be afraid of finding out, would be my question. If there are things that you don't understand. And actually, even if you did qualifications yourself, so much has changed. You know, or if you come from a country that's outside of the UK, you might not understand the system. But ask, find out the information, because you've then got the best possible opportunity of supporting your child.
Good advice. So I'm curious, what was it like being a student here?
Oh, I think it was a really interesting experience. I was a really mature student here, so it was perhaps a different experience to some. At the time, everyone did their DPhils full time, and I didn't live within Oxford.
Where were you living?
I was about 12 miles away, which is always interesting because as a postgraduate student, you have to live within a certain amount of miles from Carfax Tower and to be awarded your degree. And I was about, you know, 0.03 of a mile off, so you had to get a special dispensation to live.
Right.
So I had what was then, certainly within my cohort, was a more non-traditional DPhil experience. I think what was amazing is the breadth of experience and opportunities you have as a DPhil student. So the cohort was very, very diverse. And some of us are still in touch. It was very international, so there were lots of opportunities to learn about new research methodologies, different education systems. So it wasn't always the student experience about what did I learn through doing the DPhil and the skills. I think it was the whole wider experience, the amount of lectures you can get to, and you have to work out how you're going to be selective about that, otherwise you'd never get anything else done in life. It's really nice to be able to come back in a different life stage, actually, with children who are now grown up, where I have less constraints, I suppose, where I can really engage in opportunities that I didn't always have the opportunity to as a DPhil student. I was a parent of two young children, and so, you know, it was a different life stage. I think the really positive thing about being a DPhil student here is the challenge. You know, there was always challenge. That's always hard as an adult because you've, you know, got a bit more used to being an accomplished professional in some way. But there was always that challenge. There was always an opportunity for growth. There were always new things to learn. And Oxford's such a beautiful place to be. You know, there's so many other opportunities available to you.
It must have been quite weird coming back, was it, in a totally different guise? Or did it just feel seamless?
No, it was definitely different.
Okay.
It was definitely different having been in Oxford the first time as a young student and coming back as a mature student. But there was something really nice about the familiarity. You know, coming from outside Oxford as a somebody from a working class background, when I first came to Oxford, it was definitely a challenge. There were so many assumptions about things that you didn't even know you were supposed to know about, like you can't tread on grass in a college quad.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. So coming back was, and I think this is the same as coming back as a departmental lecturer, what is seamless is the understanding of those systems. You know what matriculation means, you know what subfusc is. So you don't have to negotiate the Oxford landscape as well as the DPhil.
Yeah.
You know, and that I think was a huge advantage amongst the other challenges that a DPhil presents. And I think I'd misunderstood really when I arrived the DPhil process. You know, I definitely thought it was about having a perfect piece of work and, you know, with targets along the way. And it was only really by the end I realised it's really very much an apprenticeship. You're learning to be an apprentice researcher. It's about the process. I mean, obviously you have to have a good standard product, but actually so much more of it is about the process. And I think I'd missed that at the beginning. That was something that I very much had to grow into.
Do you think that was the most challenging aspect?
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt.
Yeah.
You know, I came in with a plan. I thought I knew what I was doing in week two, you know, and now I think, oh, you know, I thought it was going to be a much more linear process. There's so much that's uncontrollable. So much of your thinking changes. And that isn't always a comfortable place to be. And I do think as an adult, that was much more of a challenge because I was used to being within a comfort zone, feeling competent. And really, I was out of my comfort zone. But that was the learning process. You know, that's the foundations of any academic career. Things are so rarely in a straight line. So that was definitely the learning curve.
And what was the best bit? What was the highlight, do you think?
I think for me, the highlight was just being given that opportunity. I was given a funded studentship. You know, I'm from a social background where by rights I should never have ended up at university. And so for me, the absolute highlight was just being given that opportunity. And that's why I passionately believe in people being given educational opportunity. For somebody to believe in you to get a studentship and to have that opportunity was such an honour that for me, that was the highlight.
So touching on that, what background did you come from? Where did you grow up and why would you think it shouldn't be open to you?
I think just because, so I'm from working class background from London. I didn't come from a family. My family all left school, you know, well before school leaving age. I didn't really know what a university was. That wasn't, it wasn't a concept I grew up with. It wasn't something that particularly was an option. I was in a comprehensive secondary school that didn't even have a sixth form and went to a tertiary FE college. So there wasn't the educational or familial background where it was something that was on your radar. You know, you got a good job. That was the expectation. You worked hard. But education wasn't really seen as a valuable commodity within the wider climate.
And so was there a moment that changed that for you in life?
I think it was schooling. Right. You know, I had teachers who were saying, well, but you could do this. You know, they would tell me what a university was because it wasn't something that I'd heard of. So for me, it was those kind of role models that I was just fortunate enough to meet along the way that allowed me to understand there were lots of different pathways and opportunities. But you can't make the most of opportunities if you don't know they're there or you haven't heard of them. And I think that's why I fell into looking at the model I did. It's about those expectations and values. You know, we grow up within a certain climate that becomes familiar. We're not necessarily aware of those wider opportunities.
I don't know whether this was a conscious thing, but it sounds like you sort of went through a slight transformation that then you've studied later on in life of people who perhaps, young people who didn't know the options and, like you say, therefore weren't set up necessarily for success, but how that can change when they do understand the options.
I think so, because I think for me, you know, being a researcher is lots of things, but for me, the key thing is the giving back and the impact. Otherwise, what am I doing? And so for me, what I want to do is give back for those opportunities I was given. I think that's really, really important because I'm fortunate to have them. And I think as appreciation of that, it's good to pass those on and to make a difference for others.
Do you remember what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Yeah, I wanted to be a nun or an RE teacher. Unfortunately, I talk way too much to be a nun. I did do some RE teaching, but I just fell in love with psychology.
You publish research involving mixed methods. For our listeners who don't know anything about research, what does that actually mean?
So when you do psychology, you're very much taught to analyse everything with numbers and statistics because you're told that's more robust. You know, that's the sort of school of thinking. So this was one of the learning curves. When I came to do my DPhil, I was only intending to use quantitative data because I thought that was robust. And what a quantitative analysis of large data sets means is you use lots of people. And by having lots of people, you can draw results or conclusions about how wider populations might behave using numbers. And the more data and the bigger the numbers, the more robust and the more honourable, you know, the perceptions are. And ashamedly, that was my kind of school of thought when I arrived. And I'd be sitting with a DPhil cohort where people would be interviewing, you know, 10 people for a PhD. And I was thinking, how can you get a PhD by interviewing 10 people? What kind of data is that? You know, you're only talking to people. How can that be proper data? And one of the biggest learning curves of my DPhil was learning an appreciation of how much data and how much you can understand by people's stories and how it has a different quality and different strengths. And so as part of my DPhil, I then made a conscious decision to do mixed methods research so that I could experience that. And so depending on the topic, I still do a lot of large-scale quantitative analysis because I think there is value in that kind of data and the regard it's given and what it can tell you. But it's not foolproof. Big numbers does not mean there are not flaws in that data. And sometimes it doesn't tell you the story and the quality of data can tell you the stories. So increasingly so, especially if I'm looking at something like identity. yes, the data can tell you that if you're a particular sex or you're from a particular social class or ethnicity, the data can show you X. But that doesn't tell you people's stories about how they perceive their identity. So I very much tend to now veer towards, I mean, like any research, I do what's appropriate for the research, but I will veer towards what works for that research. And the best way of collecting multiple sources to tell the story that I want to tell that is going to be helpful.
How do you translate big data sets into something tangible for young people? Is it putting in that narrative as well?
I think it's a good question. I don't think those big data sets are used for something tangible for young people.
Right.
A large data set data tends to be the policymakers. It tends to be used less by individuals and more by stakeholders.
And what are the benefits or potential pitfalls of that?
I think the benefits are it can have some real implications for policy. It can show you patterns and themes that might need addressing across a large scale. So I think it can have really widespread policy implications. The challenges, I think, are that there are always limitations to data. You know, so even if you're doing modelling, what you choose to pick and include in your model will influence the outcomes you get. So large data set data is not flawless. And also, you can only show associations, you can't show cause and effect. So you can't say you come from this background that has caused your outcomes. You know, it's not that simple. So I think they're the limitations.
Tell us about your current research. What are you working on right now?
So what we've just finished is a huge Nuffield funded project. It was actually funded through my previous post. We looked at whether the EPQ is an opportunity for all. So the EPQ is the Extended Project Qualification. And that is a project that sixth form students can do. In effect, it's a bit like a dissertation. They can do either an essay or an artifact. And they do it as an independent project, looking at something they're interested in that isn't part of their A-levels. Now, originally, that qualification was introduced to level up disadvantage for students who might not have the social capital at home to offer those opportunities. And it's awarded half an A-level. So the idea, it would give them different opportunities for access to HE or so on. And there's been some studies done, but not extensively. So we were able to do a very large scale study where we used National Pupil Database data, so a large administrative data set. We had just over 2.7 million records. And what we were able to do was look at students who'd taken the EPQ, look at their social demographic variables, gender, and so on, and look at their outcomes. So at scale, that has given a huge insight over 8 years worth of NPD data into the type of patterns and outcomes that emerge with the EPQ. However, in order to tell the story, we also had somebody who had a specialism in geographical information systems. And what they were able to do was to use maps and able to map provision of the EPQ against deprivation data, uptake of the EPQ and outcomes, so that we could see what the geographical dispersion was, not just for the outcomes, but who actually has the opportunity to do it. For example, if you lived in a city, your opportunities were greater than if you lived in a coastal area. And we also interviewed students and teachers who had either undertaken the EPQ or who were delivering the EPQ in schools, largely, although not exclusively, in areas of deprivation, with some schools who modelled it really well. And we had some schools that offered it to every student as compulsory and many who didn't. So we were also to gain insight into how it worked in practice and what the barriers were. So from that project, we had an overarching picture of the wide-scale data patterns across England. We could also see, using mapping, where opportunities were, but we also had individual insights that have allowed us to identify the barriers to students having opportunity, but also suggest some practices that might be helpful to increase opportunity.
And what do you think you'll be working on next?
So next, I'm hoping to engage in some more research that, again, is to do with opportunity, but takes an angle of looking at teacher perceptions of IQ. So over time, psychology has had many different views on how IQ is perceived, whether it's nature or nurture. And this is a debate that is evolving all the time. But very little research has been done about teachers' perceptions of IQ. And it could make a difference. You know, if teachers believe IQ is something that is innate and fixed, their approach and opportunities given to their students might be different to if they think it is something that's malleable. But it hasn't been well researched. So I'm hoping to do some research that's going to look into teachers' perceptions of that.
When you're going into new research projects, how much do you already have a view of what the outcomes might be, or do you just try to keep an open mind?
I think it's a really interesting question, okay, and I'm a psychologist, so of course my reflection on that would be you always try to keep an open mind, but inevitably as human beings, we have to be aware of the preconceptions we hold. You know, as somebody who's been a teacher in schools for 15 years, of course you have a perception. Do you allow that to dominate what your expectations are of the research? Absolutely not. But you do have to be conscious of the biases you might hold. You know, we all have them, the background we come from, the career path we've taken. But I think as a researcher, it's really important to be aware of them rather than pretend you don't have them, but to keep an open mind with any kind of research and what you might find. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it. You know, there is a tendency, I think, for all of us to work towards a confirmation bias, but any good research shouldn't.
Was there a specific experience or frustration that pushed you towards educational assessment research?
Yeah, I think it was the end of my 15-year teaching career. So when I first began my career, you would have large classes of psychology A-level students, often students who had lots of personal issues, and that's why they were interested in psychology. And for me, that was really important. They came to my class, they might not be the most able, but they learned a lot. And they would take what they've learned into their future life in all sorts of ways. By the end of my teaching career, because of the accountability and the changes in league tables, I was working in a school where you could do A-level psychology, but first of all, you couldn't do A-levels unless you had a certain amount of GCSEs at certain grades. And then it became, not only that, but in order to do A-level psychology, it's been determined that you have to have an A in, as it was then, I know it's numerical now, in English, maths and science GCSEs. And so what you had was a very different cohort of students, and you were excluding by default a lot of students for whom that education might have been valuable in wider terms other than assessment grades. And I was beginning to see that more and more, the effect on those students, their sense of self, their identity, the way they perceived themselves. And that's why I then decided that teaching was no longer the career for me. I didn't want to be the teacher standing at the front with the most able students breaking their necks at any cost to their mental health in order to achieve some grades. That isn't what I wanted to be doing with my career.
Do you ever miss it?
Sometimes I don't miss the school systems. I miss working with students, but I'm fortunate enough to be in a career where I still get to teach as well as research, and I love the teaching. I still love being in the classroom with students of any kind, making a difference, supporting them pastorally, watching them grow. So I do miss it, but I do get enough that
it's okay.
That it's okay.
Is that your favourite part of your profession currently?
I think I'm a slight anomaly in that I love it all. I really love the teaching and the pastoral work. I really love the opportunities that research has. I love the intellectual stimulation. I don't love one more than the other. But I would very much miss it if I wasn't in a classroom teaching some of the time.
Sounds like you're perfectly placed. I don't know if a lot of people could say that they love all of their job or their profession. We touched on this earlier a little bit, but do you think policymakers understand the complexity of assessment science?
Not necessarily, because they haven't been in a classroom. I think they attempt to understand it. I mean, the wider question, I guess, and I have been at conferences where the question that has been raised in response to that is, why should they? That's not their job. That's not their remit. We can't do it all. If you were a policymaker that was focused all the time on the students, could you make the policies? I think there's a balance. Of course, I think it's important, but we can't all do all aspects of every job.
It's a really good point. We're talking in the last episode to Leon, and we were talking a lot about policymakers and the link between research and what they should be involved in, what they shouldn't be involved in, and where it's appropriate or not, because ultimately sometimes they're making these huge decisions that affect everything. But like you say, they can't be experts in every field, and it's a really interesting tension. Mm. And as academics, what should the requirement be to push?
It's a wide debate in education. You know, some people would argue that it's not a teacher's responsibility to be doing pastoral work, that they're there to educate a student. Now, I don't personally agree with that view, but it is a view. You know, as an academic, are you there to pastorally support your students? Are you there to teach your students? Are you there to do good research? You know, there are different views and perspectives on these things. And I think there are valid alternative views.
Yeah. I suppose my thinking on that, you know, as a layperson, would be that you're never just getting the individual, you're never just getting the student as just the student. They're always going to come with the home stuff, right? Or whatever the background is, or their issues, or the chip on the shoulder, or the excitement for certain things, or whatever. So
how can you separate them? I would agree. As a psychologist, I think you're a whole person. You're a whole person, and the whole person needs to be worked with. So one of the big kind of trends in schools is to do trauma-informed learning. So if a kid turns up 10 minutes late, you don't say, right, you're in detention, you're late. You say, what's gone on at home this morning that means you're late? Different approaches to the same problem. But you take a whole student. And in order to achieve well educationally, you treat that whole person.
You've explored links between A-levels and identity. How do exams shape who students think they are?
I think that's an interesting question. And it's not just about how exams shape who students think they are, but actually it does shape who they can be often. So the grades achieved, if we were talking about A-levels, do actually realistically shape the options available to those students and those life chances. So it's unfortunately, the reality isn't just about their perceptions, although of course their perceptions are important, it's actually about the reality. It will be about the course choice they've got for university, the apprenticeship they can get into, whether they've even got A-levels or not. It's a complex issue that also interacts with their self-perceptions, because those self-perceptions are determined partly by their reality, as well as what they imagine. So you will get students, for example, who haven't, if they haven't got 3 A stars, will feel a failure because that's their perception. They've only got 3 A's. You will get other students who get 3 A's and that's been beyond what they achieve. So some of it is about their perceptions and we have little control over that, but some of it for them is the reality of the choices that are then available to them.
And I wonder how much that, I mean, it's easy for me to say because I'm getting old, but you're so young when you're making these decisions and you're not always the most confident person when you're that sort of age. I do wonder how much being graded sticks with you for life. As you say, as in a perception. So if you sort of got okay grades as far as you were concerned, how much does that affect, you know, your adulthood thinking? You're sort of okay. You're sort of intelligent.
I think if you ask any adult in any room to recount a story about grades and how they see themselves, we could all do it.
Yeah.
You know, as adults, when you meet people, a conversation will be, oh, hello, what do you do? It's the marker. People don't say, oh, by the way, what are your values? What kind thing have you done today? So on every level, even as adults, that is a marker, rightly or wrongly. So it's really difficult when you're saying to young people, look, these grades aren't the be-all and end-all. It's much more important that you're sociable and happy and well-rounded and have good mental health. You can say that to students, but the trouble is they don't believe you. Because although you can tell them that, they don't have the experience of the wider world. And what they see around them is, I need this grade to do this. And people think of me this way because of this grade. Because that is the reality of their world. And it might be many, many years later before they realise that's not true. And of course, students do come to different sorts of learning late. And I'm a real believer in lifelong learning and opportunities because people change over time and they mature. But I think it's really difficult for young people to conceive that. We know as adults, it's difficult for us in that kind of situation when we're put on the spot to feel that we've got to give an answer. You know, so for young people, they're in an impossible position, I think.
Looking back, what has surprised you most about your career?
I think what has surprised me most is where I've ended up. I couldn't have foreseen that. You know, it's such a privilege to be here as a lecturer, and I never fail to appreciate it. But I think also just how much the different routes I took have converged to create a cohesive, coherent career at the end.
And you couldn't have planned for that, right? That's the
funny thing. Absolutely didn't plan for that.
It wouldn't be an episode of Education Explored without me asking about AI. It's come up in every single episode. How does generative AI affect educational assessment? And what do you think the education boards need to consider?
So I'm not an expert in AI. I'm a dinosaur, you know, that still writes in coloured pen and paper. So I am the least qualified to probably comment on this. But what I would say is that AI is something that we cannot avoid. And it is becoming really prominent in assessment. Because the reality is it will shape assessment. And that is a fact. You know, whether you're talking about HE, where students submit essays, or exams that they're doing online, whether you're talking about project-based learning, the reality is AI will determine and shape the way the assessment field moves, perhaps more than most, because how do you ensure assessments are fair and valid if you bring AI into the equation? But what you certainly can't do is assume it's not going to have an effect. It's going to be finding ways to incorporate it so that we still enable students to learn effectively, and how we do that. And that's really topical. I mean, in the assessment field, AI is probably one of the most current researched and focused topics, understandably. How exam boards will work with that, how universities will work with that, how schools will work with that.
Because AI, it's going at such a pace for any of us. And it does feel like with assessment, where does it stop? How do you monitor it?
But I don't think you can think of AI in terms of that. I mean, is that any different to library resources? When I was here in 1996, if you wanted a book from the library, you had to go and order it from Stack, and it came up from the bottom and appeared on a shelf. Okay, now you can sit at home and you don't even have to go in the library door.
Yeah, yeah, very
you know,
true.
It's about what is the resource base and how do you work with it as it shifts? Because it will. But it's not the only thing that's shifted. We didn't get journal articles open access. We didn't get them online. You'd photocopy them. You know, there's always been a shift in learning and techniques. Is AI any different would be my question.
Yeah. What are the biggest challenges you foresee in education as a sector over the next few years?
I think resourcing. I think meeting the needs of students, where we've got growing social inequity, we've got growing learning disabilities, we've got an increase in mental health problems. I think the problems in wider society, how we address those in education to ensure it's a safe and fair system, is going to be the greatest challenge.
And where do you see your career going next?
Well, I hope to undertake some more research that's going to be impactful. Always learn to grow as an academic, you know, take the most of the opportunities that are there as they're presented, and that's what I would hope for.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you so much for speaking with me. You can find out more about Carol's work in our department on our website education.ox.ac.uk. Join us again next time for another episode of Education Explored, the Department of Education at the University of Oxford podcast.